like you said, from the in the Murex shell, it changes first to blue and then to purple.
And then to blue again.
No, not necessarily. You could stop it when it gets to the blue. I'm pretty sure about that. Anyway, there's an important point to make, which is the next point, which is that in the late 19th and 20th century, archaeologists found enormous numbers of broken Murex shells near the cities of Sidon and Tyre. Each was broken opposite the hypobrachial flint. This pattern is consistent with the method of extracting guard material from these snails and inconsistent with the method employed for use as food. A pit near Tyre contains both broken shells and Murex brandaris. Now, I don't know if I have this where I'm reading from now. I think I have one. I only have Mike's a copy, which I have now. I gave up. I mean, this is from this today, but I'm not doing that one yet. I think that's this thing. Sorry. So the, So the, so it says here that, a pit near Tyre contains broken shells of Murex brandaris and whatever that is, Haemastoma. A third type Murex that yields a reddish dye. Shells in a pit near Sidon contain Murex trunculus only. These same species are found off Lebanon and northern Israel even today. Now, the question is, of course, does that prove anything? The fact that archaeologically you find that there are indications that the dyeing industry in the days of yore was used these shells in order to produce some sort of dye, does that have any impact on halakha? And the argument is probably not, because all you can infer from archaeology is that these shells were used, but you don't know if these shells were used to make tchilas. You can deduce rationally, make a rational deduction that there is a link between the shells that you find and the tchilas, if they do produce a tchilas-type color, but you can't prove anything. So if you can't prove anything, you'll never end up with more than what we call in halakha a suffix. Now, suffix means something where you are in doubt. Normally, when we use the term suffix, the interesting exception to general rule, when we use the term suffix, halakha, which means a case of doubt, we're talking about a suffix iser. In other words, you have a suffix, a doubt, whether there's a prohibition involved. For example, let's say that you want to eat lettuce, and you're not sure if there are bugs there, right? So it's a suffix, right? If the bugs are a Torah prohibition, which they are, then it's a suffix d'oraisa. A suffix d'oraisa is a suffix, a case of doubt in biblical law. Now let's say another type of suffix. Let's say you live in a community where there's an Eruv, and you're not sure if the Eruv is good. So generally speaking, most of our Eruvin are put up in neighborhoods where there is no Torah prohibition to carry on Shabbos, but rather a rabbinic prohibition. So in that case, it's called a suffix derabbanan, which is a case of doubt in rabbinic law. Now, there's a difference in how we approach these sefilos, these questions. A suffix d'oraisa, we say we must go l'chumrah. Must be stringent. To take our example, if I'm not sure if they're busting the lettuce or not, I can't eat the lettuce. I have to be stringent. Why? Because I might potentially transgress the prohibition, so therefore the Torah says, don't eat it. The Torah, rabbi, somebody said, don't eat the lettuce. Okay? We don't know if the Torah says itself, the rabbi says it's a big dispute. But anyway, the way we rule, everybody agrees that we must. The principle of the suffix d'rabbanan is lakula. May be lenient. So for example, in a case, let's say you're not sure if the error is good or not. Right? So then in a case where since the suffix d'rabbanan, then you could be lenient and assume that the error is good. The only flaw in that one is, if you can check it out, then you have to check it out. But let's assume you can't check it out. So you're new to the neighborhood, you have no idea where the Eruv runs. So you just assume that it's okay. That would be a suffix d'rabbanan, and you can go with kula, you can be lenient in that respect. Now, this, however, generally, as I said, the suffix d'rabbanan is an issue specifically in terms of potential
prohibitions.
Meaning that if I'm constantly transgressing a potential prohibition, which is a Torah law, I have to be stringent. And if I'm constantly transgressing a potential prohibition, which is a rabbinic law, I may be lenient. But the case of tzitzis is a very different case. Here, this is not a potential prohibition. In the case of tchilas, rather, this is a potential additional mitzvah. No prohibition involved in not wearing tchilas. As long as your four-corner garment has strings on it, white strings, you already fulfill the requirement to avoid the prohibition of wearing a four-corner garment without tzitzis. But you can get an additional mitzvah by wearing the tchilas. So the question is, what is the status of a possible case where I might be able to get an additional mitzvah, but I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. So it's clear in such cases that nobody can require you to fulfill that mitzvah, right? Because even though we compel people with corporal punishment to fulfill definite mitzvahs, we certainly can compel them to fulfill doubtful mitzvahs. Moreover, the question is whether you have a personal responsibility to attempt to accomplish a potential mitzvah, or you don't. And it seems quite obvious that there is no requirement. That would you say, and you didn't know it's a Torah mitzvah. It's a Torah mitzvah, right? If you got the right tchilas, then you are fulfilling the Torah commandment of wearing tchilas. But even though that's the case, it seems here that which you have to go in the Torah case of doubt and biblical laws and be stringent, that's only if it concerns the prohibition. Staying away from the prohibition, you've got to take it away from the prohibition, even if it's doubtful. But it doesn't follow that if you have a possibility of fulfilling a mitzvah, a Torah mitzvah, which in the end of it, at the end of the day, you'll still be in doubt whether you fulfilled it or not, whether you're required to fulfill that mitzvah. Is that logical?
Mm-hmm.
So at best, nobody's ever going to be able to tell anybody to go here and clear it. But there's no definitive proof, there's only circumstantial evidence that tchilas is the proper tchilas. So if that's the case, anybody can always say, listen, this is something. I don't have to fulfill it. It's not incumbent upon me to go spend $100 in order to do something which I may end up not doing in the final analysis anyway. If I want to be mahater, if I want to be, you know, meticulous in my fulfillment of the mitzvah, that's my own personal business. But that is not something which I can compel anybody else to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a very powerful statement. In other words, you can't compel somebody to do a mitzvah, which is only going to be, at the end of the day, not a definite mitzvah. I can compel you to sit in the sukkah. Let's say I find you sitting outside the sukkah, right, on sukkahs, so I can beat you to within an inch of your life to make you sit in the sukkah, right? Because when you sit in the sukkah, you will be definitely fulfilling the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. Or the same thing, if I see you not refusing to listen to a shofar on Rosh Hashanah, so I can beat you until you actually come to listen to shul to listen to a shofar, right? But I can't do there, after you hear the shofar, you'll definitely have fulfilled the mitzvah. In fact, in the sukkah, you'll definitely have fulfilled the mitzvah. Here, the guy says to me, you know, leave me alone. Even if I go and wear the tchilas, I still don't know if I fulfill the mitzvah. So therefore, how can you compel me to fulfill that mitzvah? Okay? So that's, even if we have lots and lots of circumstantial evidence, like archaeology, or like we said yesterday, the proof that the New York trunk of the shell fits in very well with the Gemara in Shabbos, which talks about cracking open the shell and wanting the snail to still remain alive in order that the brazai should not start deteriorating, even that fits in very, very well with the circumstance of your trunculus shell. Nevertheless, it can never be a definite, and therefore we can never require anybody to wear clothes. Now, if you turn to page 2 of Rabbi Trusty's article, he mentions here on top that this indigo is chemically identical when you produce blue from your trunculus.
The last two lines on the first page,
mm-hmm.
It was discovered that it can turn from purple to blue. And at the little footnote, it says that when you treat it to be water to make the dye water soluble so that it can be dyed, mm-hmm. you have to deoxide it in a reduced state. Then you expose it to sunlight and it turns
purple. Right, you're right. Says, you're right. It does say that. But, okay. Maybe, but no, maybe I got it wrong. I'm willing to accept that. So the, if you change the chemical structure of indigo, that's this. Believe me, it makes no sense to me. I'm sure many of you are great scholars, so this makes sense to you. Me, makes no sense. Fine, it's not something which is close to my heart. So the, at least not chemistry. So the, there's indigo, a blue color which is derived from plants. And there's the indigo, the blue color which is derived from the snail. And in essence, they've discovered that the chemical structure of both these blue dyes is identical. Meaning, however the dye is produced from the snail, or if the dye is produced from plants, it ends up being the same dye. Now, we assume, therefore, that this dye, which is the chelet, right, is very, similar to, this is the first thing which the Gemara says. The Gemara says that the naked eye cannot distinguish between chelet strings which are colored with fish blue or snail blue and chelet strings which are colored with plant blue. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says that why does it say in Shema, in the last chapter of the Shema, Ani Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hoteiti Etchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. I am the God, your Lord, who took you out of Egypt. That tells us all about Mrs. Sisis. It says, I am the God, your Lord, who took you out of Egypt. What is the connection between Sisis and taking us out of Egypt? So there are many connections which could be made. But the Gemara Bava Metzia says, I'll tell you what the connection is. God said, in Mitzrayim, I was able to distinguish what individual, what Bechor was Jewish, and which Bechor was non-Jewish. And only smote the Bechoros, the firstborn, of the Egyptians, not the firstborn of the Jews. So I am able to tell the difference between X and Y, even if they're hidden from the naked eye. I know the difference between Kol Elon and Chelet, and I'm going to attack you if you wear Kol Elon, even though nobody else realized it, because I do. So just like I took you out of Egypt and was able to discern there, I can discern who's doing wrong with the Kol Elon. Now, the question is, of course, if there's no difference, it would seem that there's no way to test the difference between color E1 and Chelet. And this is the weakest part, what I'm coming to, is the weakest link in the chain of the assumption that modern Chelet is Chelet. Yet Gemara does say, in one place, that there is test in Menachos. I think we actually can... probably from one of the sheets here. Excuse me?
It's in there somewhere.
Yeah, so you,
yeah, on the first page, the first sentence? The first page?
No, there's somewhere I think it's probably more explicit. Okay. If you take a look in
the third one.
Page 3.
Yeah.
Okay, in page 3,
the color is the color.
Yeah, the color is chelet. Come on, that's, yeah. The Talmud, while some cases are held to, by nearly all to be blue, Dr. Sol's vitamin has suggested this is not so. He marshals much evidence to prove that Murex truncus is indeed chelazon, while the chelet is not blue, rather purple with a bluish shade. He presents the following argument. The Talmud and Menachos ask how one can distinguish between clay, elon, and chelet. The Gemara describes the method of chemical testing. The threads are soaked in a series of chemicals. If the color does not fade, it is chelet. If it does, then it should be subjected to another series of chemicals. If the color becomes bright again, it is chelet. If it remains faded, it is clay, elon. Now, if dye came from truncus, it's chemically identical to indigo, then there would be no difference at all between the two. Any chemical that would fade one would fade the other. And similarly, any chemical that will not fade one will not fade the other. If, however, the color of chelet is purple, then we can suggest that artificial chelet was a combination of the indigo dye from a plant with a red dye. It is the red dye that will be affected by the chemicals stated in the Gemara. pure prayers will stay fast, while the erzak prayers will fade. So he brings down Yehuda Ruch, the rabbi in Israel, in disagreement with Dr. Zeideman, brings evidence that the color of chelet is a pure blue. Among his proofs is the Rambam's statement that chelet is the color of the sky, and the Gemara's assertion that the color is like that of the sea. Neither the sky nor the sea are purple or any shade of purple. The table in footnote 13 says Zeideman notes that immediately after sundown the sky is purple, due to the mix of the sun's red rays and the blue sky. Even so, this does not explain the link to the color of the sea. Rambam says, sir, the color of the sky by sunlight. So therefore, he rejects this color. Further proof may be induced from the universal tradition that chelet is translated as blue wool. Rabbi Leiner makes this point against those who claim that chelet was green or black. Greek translations made when chelet was extant translate chelet as iakintos, which transliterated as hyacinth, a blue-colored flower. Possible resolutions of the riddle of the chemical testing may lie in the morning used for dyeing with the plant indigo. That's chemicals which are reduced into the dye to make the color fast. The types of mordants commonly used for indigo might be different from the mordants used for Murex trunculus. It is also possible that while the dye chemicals of the Murex trunculus extract and plant indigo are identical, impurities inherent in both animal and vegetable materials have some effect upon the take of the dye into the fabric. So, as I said, this test in Menachos is the most difficult piece of evidence for which the Murex people, with the Murex people, have to deal. Because it's very difficult to assume that two chemicals are identical, and yet there's a test which can distinguish between the two. So they have to come on to these hypotheticals. Now, the truth is, you might ask the question, which is a legitimate question, why did nobody ever run the test and see what happens? Maybe you run the test, there will end up being a difference between the two, or maybe there won't. So the reason we're nobody's run the test is because
know what the chemicals are.
We have no clue what these chemicals are in the Gemara Menachos. Let me just give you an example. We don't know how to use them. We don't know what some of them are. We don't know what measures to apply them.
Yeah, we hear some chemicals, and that's one of the only difference that come out of Hashem made these two differences between the plants.
I don't buy that.
No.
Nice try. But it says here, this, by the way, Mark Melvin's assistant to discuss a great length. So it says here, first his opinion that chelet can only be bought from an expert. And the reason why that would be, it would make sense, because if they're identical to plant indigo, so they're going to get from an expert who's believed, who's trustworthy, because he'll tell you that in fact it's extracted from the snail. But then there's an opinion, that's what it says again, because chelet ain't what bedikla. Chelet cannot be checked. The same thing, now that makes sense if you say the same thing as plant indigo. But then when it says, Vara Yitzu Breda, use a body plate. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Yehuda, checked it. How did he check it? Maisa Megadya, he would bring Megadya Gila. Megadya Gila is alum. Alum is some sort of chemical. And Maya de Shavuisa, water which comes out from flax. Umeyne Rav Lime, ben Arboimiyom, and urine from a child who was 40 days old. Or there's another shot here, a child who is the urine itself has been age for 40 days. Obviously, at that point, it's very acidic or whatever it's supposed to do. But entirely, if you mix the chelet, the wool in this, mikurta ba'atha safra, from evening till morning, right? If it's chazusa, if the dye separates, then sula is no good. But if it's chazusa, if the dye doesn't separate, kishera, it is kosher. Then the Gemara brings down the different test. Amr Meister, it says, Meister Chamira, Akasur Desare, you bring a very tough sourdough, very potent sourdough, and you bake the chelet inside this sourdough. And if it changes, then it becomes better, then it is kosher. It becomes worse, it looks worse, it is not kosher. And so on and so forth. So all these things, it's very difficult to know exactly what we're using here, especially because we don't know what kind of urine to use. And it's very difficult to run this test, because you have to run the test overnight, and somebody's got to stir, so nobody's actually ever run this test to actually ascertain whether there's a difference between regular chelet and the chelet which comes from indigo. I have to tell you that, personally, getting back to what I said before, I don't really believe in science. I don't, meaning that I think that science, even whatever, with all due respect to the chemists, I don't believe that they know everything. Matter of fact, I believe they know very little. And I'll give you an example why I think that way. There's an article which was written in 1972 by a couple of rabbis, who were rabbis out of Chicago, which they argued that, based on medical knowledge, which was true at the time, that any individual who has a flat EKG, in other words, there's no brain activity which shows up in an electronic monitor, is dead. That's it, is dead. So therefore, you could harvest his organs, you can, you know, take him off any life support, etc., etc. Medical knowledge advanced beyond that, and we now know that a person can survive and put, even bounce back, if, even if at one point they had a flat EKG. They certainly can survive without any external life support system, if everything else is working well, and they can survive for many years after you remove the life support system from them, because the brain stem, which they didn't know at the time, the brain stem actually controls the most basic activities such as breathing and digesting and all that kind of stuff. So therefore, even if your brain is technically speaking dead, you can still survive as long as your brain stem is alive. Okay. So then, later on, Rabbi Sandler from Muncie came to the conclusion that, well, if your brain stem is dead, so then you're dead. And then we can harvest your organs. And he says, if your brain stem is dead, so then you have undergone a physiological decapitation. Even though your head is still attached to your body, it's as if it no longer is attached to your body, and therefore you are halakhically dead and your organs can be harvested. So Shlomo Zalman writes about this. He says, I'm paraphrasing, he says, look, medical knowledge has changed in the past, whatever, 20 years, from the time one physician was taken to the next physician was taken. But that's not going to change in the next 20 years. Ultimately, we don't know what the point of death is, other than when the neshama leaves the body. And how do we know when the neshama leaves the body? Maybe the neshama leaves the body before the brain stem is dead. Maybe the neshama leaves the body at some point after the brain stem is dead. In the Gemara itself, it only says that you can determine death based on cessation of respiration. There is no other way to determine death which the Gemara gives. So therefore, who says that there is such a thing as brain stem death or brain death, which is a legitimate halachic perspective? So that's not really our topic for today. But what I really want to point out from here is that medical knowledge changes over time. Halacha really is the absolute. It's medicine that changes. So the same thing here with the chemistry. I don't believe necessarily that the way chemistry or the science of chemistry is today is necessarily the last word of chemistry. It may well be that 10 years down the line, they will discover that there's some nuance, there's some difference between plant indigo and fish indigo, which they had, or snail indigo, which they haven't yet come across. And at that point, it'll be clear to us what Chazal were testing for. The fact that today we don't have such a test doesn't indicate that no that test won't exist. Yeah.
I think what he says here is the thing is to compare two chemicals, right? You can extract that the chemical indigo and you can extract that out and collect it and you'll see that it's the same as the stuff that you got. But there's always impurities in the thing. So like he says here that the difference could be that when you take indigo from the snail, it's indigo with, you know, some extra snail stuff in it. And when you take, even if you extract everything out, there's always some resident impurities. And so even though chemistry is correct in that the indigo, the actual blue indigo is chemically identical, the extra things that are, you know, they didn't have laboratories back then, like, you know, everything wasn't completely purely filtered out because they didn't have, you know, electron microscopes or anything to actually get every molecule out of there. So all the residue from the plant versus the residue from the snail could have a difference in whether it would fade, where it would react with the indigo blue.
I know that they say that, but that's, I'm saying, even were that not to be the case, forget it, the impurities were not there for some reason.
Well, then, indigo is indigo. I mean, you can't...
No, I don't buy that. That's what I'm saying. I don't buy that.
I buy that.
I know you buy that.
Heard it. I know. You can't, there is no difference.
I don't think that's true. That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's necessarily true, since they don't say that. No, that's true. Because I don't know either. But I don't... To me, as a layman, I'm skeptical that indigo, which comes from plants, is chemically identical in all aspects of indigo which comes from snails.
Yeah,
just a division of molecules and they're connected. The only reason, the chemically identical just means that you have, like, you know, two carbons attached to an oxygen attached to hydrogen in this pattern. And you can do that. And then you can do that in that. And that's all it is just those. And all those are just those. And there's no difference between the two.
But you don't know, just like, you know, they have, again, this is my ignorance, but ignorance is bliss. Just like when they, in space, right, they were doing experiments all these years, so they found the, what they're looking for, the,
you're driving with?
What? No, the substance of which the universe is made.
Oh, ether.
Ether, right.
So right, yeah.
They didn't find ether, once they thought it was ether, right? And
right.
Then
they have no evidence for it.
Right, they determined that there is no ether. But yeah. Now they determined that there is something, since there is some, and there's some sort of particles between, you know, between known planets, which are somehow explained, I don't remember exactly how it works, because something which isn't interesting me that much. But there has to be some particles in the space between various different planets in order to explain the residual temperature of 3.5 degrees above absolute zero. And there are all sorts of things which they claim they can discover or have discovered based on, you know, measuring the wavelength of various different emissions.
Well, there's still not ether.
Whatever it is, doesn't matter. Don't call it ether, call it whatever you want. But the same thing, I don't know necessarily that everything between the molecules has necessarily been discovered.
They haven't. Well, I mean, they discovered down the quarks and stuff, but the thing is, the molecules are the determined chemicals, not those inside the molecules.
How do we know that?
Like, if you have water, you can take water from here and water from the other side of the planet. They're chemically identical, and they react exactly the same as the water. It's water. I mean, it's like comparing water to water. I mean, you can't say that, oh, there might be something inside the molecules that we don't understand. There is stuff that we don't understand inside the molecules, but that doesn't make a difference between this water and this water, because it's still down to H2O.
I don't necessarily believe that the water is that side of the world is identical to water on this side of the world. That all water tastes the same. Obviously not all water tastes the same. That actually was what's dissolved within the mindset. But I'm skeptical that even purified water from each end of the world will actually taste the same. Now this I know it's completely anti-scientific, but it's a personal skepticism which I have. That, look, it may be, you know, I'm perfectly willing to live with this, that there's a difference between them, the impurities, but, in fact, I would say, a skeptic would take it a step further and say, science constantly changes. Everything changes in science, and the latest theory is based on the latest data. But then the data change, and then the theory changes. So therefore, I'm not so sure that, you know, it's so smooth to assume that science is a question. Anyway, so moving along on this, so as I said, that is the most difficult.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm leaving. I have to come to
California. Oh, that's it? Yes.
I came for 10 days only.
Okay. So when are you going to come for longer?
Hopefully in the summer.
The summer. Okay.
I have to see
you. All right. Good. Back with the
pay
stuff. Hope to see you back.
Thank you.
Right
now?
We're living in my country. Yeah. Take
care.
Thank you.
So moving along with the Tehillim, so there's a couple of other things which we should speak about here, which is if you take a look on page 2, going back to page 2, let's talk about the Ravina set. The Ravina set, as you mentioned, the Ravina Rebbe identified the common cuttlefish, Cichlea officinalis, as Chilazo. He amassed much evidence to prove this. Many were convinced by the weight of his evidence and the strength of his conviction. He was a tough guy. Rabbi Herzog studied Rabbi Leiner's tape with great interest and subjected his arguments to rigorous analysis. He obtained samples of Ravina Chelis and sent it to 3 different laboratories in 3 different countries for chemical analysis. The results astonished him. All 3 laboratories came to the same conclusion. The dye claimed to be Chelis was a well-known synthetic dye, first synthesized in 1704, known to the world as Prussian blue. Rabbi Herzog asked the late Ravina's son to inform him of the exact process by which the chalice was made. I should share that with you because they do have it on this handout here. Take a look at the last page. We'll see how the Ravina's make chalice. You see that addendum? Translation letter for Rabbi Zina is copied in the original Hebrew in the thesis. Under thesis is Rabbi Herzog's thesis. Under the heading of Dying Receipts, communicated by a certain Mr. Joshua Meyer Teitelgitzer, implying the absence of Rabbi Mordechai Yosef Weiner, the son of the successor of Gershon Henoch Weiner. So it says, your letter of the 20th January this month was addressed to our Reverend Rabbi is indeed arrived. And since he is temporarily not at home, having traveled from here some days, and since I am able to fulfill your request, I hereby inform you that the packet of papers enclosed herewith reaches you by the post, forthread, doubly sealed, notice it shouldn't be tampered, as prescribed by holy law. And according with your request, you can be assured that the papers herewith enclosed is from the extract of the shellfish's blood without any other dye. And as I know this work well, I can explain here all the chemicals that are mixed with the shellfish blood. Shellfish blood is not actually blood. That's why it's thick every time. It's an ink. And whoever is familiar with the nature of the chemicals knows that they are completely colorless. They are all white, and some of the appearance of ordinary water, except for the blood, which is colored. The shellfish's blood that is located in the sack is as black as ink, and is so coagulated that it may break and shatter, being so hard. This blood is placed in a very thick bag, and one adds iron filings and also a snow-white chemical called potash. After keeping on a large, powerful fire for some 4 or 5 hours, until the conflagration burns outside and within as the fire of hell, then the blood, the iron filings, and the white chemicals fuse and become one piece. Afterwards, one empties all this mixture from the thick vat and places it in a very great deal of clean water, and a fire is lit under the large vat, and this mixture it with the clear water boils for some days. It is necessary to add the water and wet every so often, or the fire naturally diminishes the water by virtue of the boiling. Afterwards, this whole concoction is placed on a filter, or lets it stand, and one obtains the clear liquid in which the blood has been boiled, and the blood is retained, in other words, the soup. And that soup is placed again in the clear vat on the fire, and is cooked for a further time until it becomes crystalline by the cooking. Afterwards, it is emptied in cups, and many incrustations that adhere to the walls and edges of the cups are filtered and poured from the cups, and the fine incrustations are obtained that are the essence and extract of the blood. The appearance of this extract resembles coarse salt on a cloudy day, pale white, dunkel white. Part of the salt is placed in a pure vat with a quantity of water and the chemicals tartar, the porax, ammonium muriatic, acid sulfuric. One place is also the wolf spun for assistance and for the ritual of Kalis, and a fire is lit beneath the vat. Thus it stays until the wool absorbs the dye from the vat and the water remains in the vat. Again, one waits the required amount of time, and then one prepares another vat full of clear water and pours a little acid sulfuric chemical into the water. A fire is lit under the vat until it is hot, and the dye wool is again placed in it and kept there for the required interval, thereby terminating its drying. For after the wool has absorbed the dye in the vat containing the shellfish blood and chemicals, since it tends to be absorbed, the proper appearance was not externalized under threat, as being contained and concealed within. But in this last vat of hot water, the true you appears off on the outside, just as it existed within the already hidden within the wool. This is the complete method for making dye and dyeing wool for the ritual cleanliness, there being no more. Not knowing you, but best wishes, Joshua Mayer, Keiko Visser, writing in the house of the Reverend Rabbi. So what the Rabbi Herzog
did process.
You see, that's what probably made it feel real to them. Because it took a long time and a lot of efforts, right? It was big. The question is, how many steps were actually necessary? I don't know, because I don't know how you can produce Prussian blue. But I suspect that a lot of these steps, which they did, were whoever the chemist was who hoodwinked the original Rabbi Weiner, were he put them in order to make it seem like this is a very complex process, which has nothing to do with Prussian blue. But in fact, the chemicals, the colorless chemicals, which they put in at the beginning, those are really the dye. And it happens to be that the reaction of those chemicals with the organic material of the ink is what made the Ravina Tchelis turn blue. In fact, also another thing about the blue of the Ravina is that's not color fast. It says that Tchelis is color, so the Gemara says Tchelis is color fast except under the conditions which are given in the test, and therefore you can put any bleach or detergent on them and the color won't run. It won't fade. But the Ratina Pelus does fade if you put it into bleach or detergent. The only thing which doesn't cause the Ratina Pelus to fade is vinegar. So now Rabbi Ratina claims that when the Gemara says it doesn't run or fade, it's specifically talking about when you put it in vinegar, not any other bleach or detergent. Because otherwise, of course, his Pelus would not have been the right Pelus. It's hard to assume that you take a look here on the third, the second page. It says here in the paragraph we saw before, the ink was not necessary. Chemicals added to the mixture where the basis of the results are, the ink is not necessary ingredient for the device of the special process. Any organic compound would do. In fact, delicious Russian blue was manufactured using ox blood as an ingredient. Recognized the Ratzina Rebbe's great integrity, Rabbi Herzog suggested Rabbi Leiner had enlisted a chemist to find a method to change the black ink to blue. The chemist did his best by introducing chemicals necessary to synthesize Russian blue. Iron, potash, ammonium chloride, uric acid, sulfuric acid, and tartaric acid. The only element that the organic compound, be it cyclia ink or any other organic substance, contributes is nitrogen. Rabbi Leiner assumed that since the added chemicals are either clear or white, that the blue color must be inherent in the black ink. He thought that the chemicals only remove impurities from the ink, leaving on a pigment extracted from the cuttlefish itself. He was convinced that the Prussian blue dye was the chelos that he had taught. Obviously, however, the secretion of chelos that makes the chelos must be the dye itself, not an inconsequential ingredient that can be supplied by any organic source. Now, here he says a couple of other things, about why the chelos of the Ratzina is, he thinks, is not the right chelos. Among them, that it says that the chelosone lives in the sand, and cuttlefish do not live in the sand. So that's one of the things on which Rabbi Twist was attacked. If you take a look at the page that I give you today, so he was attacked by Dr. Mendel Singer, who authored this document.
But he already just proved it. The other thing. But I mean, like, it doesn't really matter if it was official.
Right, but he does say point number one. Rabbi Chaim Trotsky, many of the key articles assert cuttlefish cannot exist in the sand. Here he named the first chelos paper by the Ratzina was called, by the way, I think that the Rabbi Dr. Singer is a Ratzina Chassid, that's what I heard. Well, by Ratzina was called Spurin Shmuley Chol, and he was by all accounts a great fellow scholar and scientist. I found it rather hard to believe he could have missed it. Since I was reading Rabbi Chaim Trotsky's article online, I checked the insert from the encyclopedia online and found a short entry on cuttlefish. It said that could a cuttlefish spend their days buried in the sand and swim about at night? This is true. It actually says that, I checked. Apparently, this characteristic behavior of the cuttlefish to bury themselves in the sand. Yet, Peel claims otherwise, since people make trailers. Nobody bothers to check the facts before publishing. So I actually asked Rabbi Trotsky about this. And he said he made a mistake. The fact was wrong. In fact, that is not true, because he did not realize the cuttlefish actually live in the sand. So that proof is not a good proof. And if you go through a lot of what the objections are here in Dr. Singer's little article here, he really doesn't have any convincing arguments that the chelos is definitely not chelos. If you take a look at page 2, he says that man, he was basically trying to sustain the Ratzina chelos, and he says in the second paragraph, about halfway down the Marsham, Rabbi Shlomo Mordechai Shvadron did not rule as chelos, but was favorable and publicly wore his house was chelos. It was buried in it according to the court of his will. Rabbi Chaim Oizer Brzezinski, Rabbi Chaim Merlin also wore chelos, but privately. As far as I know, rumors about Rabbi Herzog burying privately are just rumors. The private correspondence to Rabbi Kovner, Rabbi Zilchon Spector, was also favorably inclined, but was unable to take a public stance in favor due to certain matters because Nefesh was involved in, as he said, he wanted to be made a mockery of. So the cover time was in the sukkah, he was in doubt. This hardly makes him wise, except it, but the picture is quite different than the way Steele paints it. They make a laughing stock out of Ravdin, and this is not warranted. In fact, I believe it takes away from Steele being taken seriously by Gedolim. I've been told personally by Rosh Hashiva that the attitude displayed in Steele's articles was so haughty that he knew there couldn't be any merit to their position. He did look into the matter, recognized some fatal flaws to the Murek's position, and then dropped the issue without publishing. Oh, the unscrupulous Italian chemist story, this is a fabrication. Rabbi Herzog made up the story of his dissertation, but was honest enough to state that this was entirely in speculation without any shred of evidence to any part of the whole story. Rabbi Herzog speculates on the why of puzzling unresolved matters throughout his dissertation. He wasn't trying to fool anyone. The result, however, is like a rumor. Parts of the story get dropped, and people start to think the story is fact. So, Lamaise said, there's a lot of innuendo.
It still works, though.
It still works. So then, but he really has the, he really comes to the conclusion, he doesn't really provide a conclusion, a definitive conclusion, that actually something else should be claimed. So the bottom line is that there's a lot of evidence that it is actually Caleb. As I pointed out last week, at the beginning of the week, I want to finish with Caleb there, so I'm a bit of a rush. Let's look at page 4, Rabbi Twersky's article. The main issue, the other I love consideration, is this. The main opposition to Caleb comes from you. When Rabino represented his clients to the glory saw this time, he met with resistance. Among the most significant responses were those of the Kutna Rav, Rabbi Shua Trump, there's Rabbi Shua Kutna, author of the Yishuv Malko, and the Briska Rav, Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, author of the Beit Soloveitchik. The Kutna Rav based his rejection on the fact that the dye was made with added chemicals. He quoted Rashi and Tosfos as inferring that the color of the extract of the chilozon itself was the dye color. As we've seen, the Kutna Rav's argument was right on target. The suspicion that the added chemicals were the main coloring agent was the very same objection that Rabbi Herzog later proved. Of course, this objection does not apply to mirrored succulents, as it indeed is brewed before any chemicals are added. The added chemicals only enable the dyeing process and do not affect the outcome of the dye itself. The Beit Soloveitchik's objection is more complicated. Even exactly what he said is a matter of disagreement, and quite unverifiable, since we have no written record. His letter to Rabino was not written verbatim in the Rabino's third sefer, but was paraphrased. Rabbi Yossi Ben Soloveitchik, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston, records a different version to his great-grandfather's objection. According to Rabino Rebbe, the Beit Soloveitchik's complaint was that to accept Sikhi officialis as chilozon, we must explain why it was not used for 13 centuries. If it was available, then the very fact that it was not used during this entire time is ample proof that it is not the chilozon, because it was a common dye. Rabino countered that the science of making a blue dye out of the blank black ink was indeed lost. It was only after much effort that he rediscovered the process. In addition, identification of the fish itself would have been lost over time. The loss of the process would eventually have resulted in the loss of identification of the species. It would appear that the Beit Soloveitchik was not satisfied with this answer. The cuttlefish is a common sea animal and was available in many places in the world where the Jews lived. Evidently, it did not seem reasonable to him that the CPO would be so unavailable that the science of making the dye would have ever been lost. This objection does not apply to New York Struntulus, which is an uncommon species. Had a generation gone by without Jews in northern Israel, as in the 6th century of the Common Era, then the identification of the species would have been forgotten. Now, according to Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, the objection was much more basic. The reason his great-grandfather did not accept CPO was simply because we no longer have a Masorah regarding the identity of the Chilozon. Without a Masorah, we cannot know that we have identified the Chilozon. Rabbina did not counter this objection because it wasn't presented to him. We ourselves might argue that Halacha does not require absolute certainty in the establishment of a factual matter, but only reasonable basis. Rove, follow the majority, and Chazakah, follow the status quo, the two most basic instruments of Halacha in matters of Isser and Heter, of that which is permitted and that is prohibited, are prime examples of Halacha's instruction to follow reasonable assumptions, even if there is no certainty of that. Halacha's basis of identifying Halacha is simple. The evidence has created an umbrella muchach, a relative certainty that exceeds the power of Rove, of majority. Rove is not sufficient basis, for example, to decide monetary issue against a defendant, yet an umbrella muchach, that which is a relative certainty, may be sufficient. It matters in mitzvot, even of iser, of prohibitions, where rove is sufficient to determine, despite a matter of fact, we may rely upon the umdana of the muchach. So therefore, the bottom line is that the main objection today in the among those who regard chelet as not being the right thing, and therefore advise not to wear chelet, is this objection, which is the core name of the Beit Soloveitchik, that it's mesorah is the only way by which things can be determined. And if you want to take it from a theological perspective, what they're saying is, I think I mentioned this earlier this week, but just repeat it again, is that all of Judaism is based on tradition, from generation to generation. If you challenges to Judaism, generally come from outside the tradition and from, you know, other disciplines or areas of knowledge, which then tradition is used to fend off. Here, you're trying to do the exact opposite. There is no tradition, and you're trying to introduce a practice from outside tradition into a community in which that tradition was unknown. So from the Beis HaLevi's perspective, that is not considered to be a legitimate exercise of science or other evidence which you have for you to have. The only way you can introduce a mitzvah or an observance is on the basis of the Mesorah, on the basis of some sort of existing tradition. Which is, as I mentioned when we first began, is why Rambam said that Eliyahu HaNavi is so crucial to the process of redemption. Because without Eliyahu HaNavi, there are many traditions which we will not know how they went in the time when they were extant in order to restore them. So therefore, this argument here is to adopt something from outside tradition is a very questionable practice.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're using quotes from Gemara to try to prove this fact. I mean, like, Gemara is using scientific disciplines in itself, of using chemicals to dye it and showing, you know, how to extract it and things like that, mm-hmm. and determine it. So we're just basing ourselves on what the Gemara says about it.
Okay.
And also, does anyone ever say that maybe the whole reason why Hashem, you know, implanted these ideas of science into people was so that we would rediscover the Tehillos in order to, because we're getting towards the end of the
I think
end
that
of days.
The people who are pro-Tehillos say that. Not the people who are anti-Tehillos.
Right, because, I mean, it's only popped up now. Like,
right.
I mean, in the last, you know, 50 years we've got all this evidence, so.
One thing I'm not going to get into with this, obviously that's an open issue of discussion. One thing I don't want to get into because, you know, it's enough. We'll have to do some payback for the next few days that we have remaining for us. But is that I mentioned already, there's a big argument as to how many sets of strings should be Tehillos, whether it's one, I'm meaning a half, a whole, which would look like two, or four. There's also a big difference between is how to tie them. In fact, you know, the way our sittes are tied, the conventional way in which sittes are tied today, is only the Ashkenazic way of tying them. The Yemenites have a completely different way of tying sittes, which is they don't have knots, and they just have their strings in groups of three, like going round three, another three, another three, seven times.
How does it stay up?
Because it's knotted inside. It's hard to
okay.
In other words, it's not just a slip knot.
Okay.
So that's how it stays up. And there also and those are called julios, these groups of threes. Also, there are other different opinions as to how to, whether we do, Ashkenazi do 7, 8, 11, and 13. 7 is the days of the week. 8 is, you know, represents the Mila, that which is above the days of the week. 7 and 8 together is 15, the first two letters of the name of God. 11 is 6 and 5, the last two letters of the name of God. And 13 represents the 13 attributes of mercy, right? And the Rashi goes to the whole Chesed now, also used in Rashi and Chumash, it comes out to 613, the whole with all the knots and the strings. I don't remember exactly how it worked out. The commemoration of 613. But that's not at all clear that that's the way they did it in the time of the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't say it all comes from Darisa. So the question is exactly how they did it in the time of the Gemara. So the way when I asked to have my Tehillos done, it's a very big pain to do. Anybody ever make tzitzis?
My roommate tried to.
To make tzitzis like this takes less than 15 minutes each corner. About 10 minutes a corner, maybe even 5 if you're a rush. 5 minutes a corner. 10 minutes a corner. I once tried to make Tehillos. Now, Tehillos, I tried to make according to the way the Rav Ziner had it. The way the Rav Ziner has it is you have, I didn't bring it in today, I can show you on the at home. You have a white string at the beginning and a white string at the end. And then in the middle, they're all blue. All the wraps in the middle are blue. Okay? So that's already confusing because here's the same string which makes all the wraps the entire way. There you have two strings making the wraps, the white and the blue. But besides that, he also says, this way the Bible should tie their tzitzis even though they wear all white. You should make, the Gemara speaks about having chulios. And the Gemara says the chulia is three strings together. And it seems that the chulios were essential to the tzitzis. Meaning, when there is no tzitzis, it doesn't matter exactly how you tie them. But when there is tzitzis, you're supposed to do things in groups of three. So what the Radina has you do is you go three, then you go under, and you come up above. And you do three, you go under, and come up above. That way you have groups of three within your tzitzis. That's an extremely difficult thing to do, especially when I used to do it. And so when I once made my own playlist, it took me about an hour each quarter to do. And
did it come out nice?
No, in the end, I didn't finish it. There's still an unfinished work which I have. So I actually got a free set from the playlist people in Israel, so I had them do it. And when they do it, I happen to do like the Reb Wiener has it by. And but according to the Rambam Shita, the Rambam Shita is only one thread. Again, it's the most simple Shalom Chumash, one out of the eight, and then they do it for you, so it doesn't take that much time. So in any case, but there's many, many shitas as to how many strings to have. So even once you determine what the tchilas is, you're still in a quandary exactly to know how many strings you're supposed to have. So you know, that's why a lot of people tend to the minimum, A, because it's cheaper. Because less males have to be killed in order to make a tchilas. And B, because the assumption is, if you do too much, then you know, you're adding on to the mitzvah, and that's not necessarily a good thing. But it looks like if you're doing the minimum, so you can't be said to be adding on. Now, it could be said you're subtracting, but not really, because that which the one is always included in the four. So then, well, I didn't get to the end, so to speak, but I did one out of the four. Anyway, it's a matter which remains up in the air and a matter of great confusion and various different opinions.
So the white strings, the way we tie them, I heard that like the first knot is derabanan, and all the rest of the knots are just minhag. So
the first knot is deraisa.
Yes. And the rest of the
two knots are deraisa.
Two knots are deraisa, and the rest of the is just minhag.
Right.
Right. So with tekelis, you're saying it's not that way. With tekelis, is actually a mitzvah to tie a certain way.
Or is it? No, it's not mitzvah. It's more the custom which was the prevalent at the time.
Okay, so we're still talking about minhagim, so it's not really.
But it's a more
super, super much of an issue of how you tie it.
It's not a major issue.
It's more of an issue of how many strings you have.
Right, exactly. The many strings issue is more of an issue than how you tie it.
Right, that is true.
Okay, we'll stop here, and we'll take up tomorrow with the champagne.